Welcome to another edition of the Baseball America podcast. I'm J.J. Cooper, joined by John Manuel, and we're doing this. Normally, we sit side by side when we do this. Today, we are separated by many hundreds of miles because I'm here at the Baseball America world headquarters in Durham, North Carolina, and John is currently on his balcony in his hotel room at the Opryland Hotel, the biosphere that that basically encompasses all the winter meetings, and it seems like almost all of Nashville. Is that a fair way to put it, John?
It seems like it's all of Nashville, but I know it's not. I know there's a cooler part of Nashville that's out there somewhere. So, but it's outside the Biodome. I did take the opportunity yesterday to walk outside across the street. At the, I was invited to speak at the Sports Management Worldwide symposium that they do across the street here at the inn at Opryland. I was on a panel with Josh Rawich of the Diamondbacks and Rob Nyer of SB Nation. So that was neat. It's actually my first time to meet Rob in person, so that was a pleasure. And the bigger pleasure was getting out of the Biodome and actually walking across the street. Jim Callis actually took the occasion today to go visit Vanderbilt's campus.
Yeah, he's scouting.
But apparently it was raining, so bad day for Jim to take his campus visit. So, but I've been in the Biodome, and I think, JJ, as a result of being locked in the Biodome and breathing the same stale air, I think I caught another case of Rule 5 fever.
Oh, well, it's good to know, you know, because I've had a low-grade Rule 5 fever now for, you know, really ever since the 40-man rosters were set, so... But
that's it.
I think you have a higher case. You're running a little. Your fever's running a little hotter than mine right now. Probably because I'm.
Mine had abated, and I was starting to worry about whether we were even going to do this podcast. But in the run up to the podcast and writing up some more guys, texting and emailing with scouts, I got the fever. So I'm pretty excited.
So, well, since you're there, we'll start with that. So, what is? What's the Rule 5 buzz? And I know that the reality is, you know, having been to winter meetings, the Rule 5 buzz actually doesn't start till about, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night on the night before the Rule 5 draft. That's the rule of Rule 5 buzz. But the little bit of Rule 5 buzz that is out there in the lobby, what's the Rule 5 buzz?
Well, it is interesting because the media, you know, you ask them about the Rule 5, and, you know, basically I think the media is trying to just figure out if their clubs are going to do anything or not. I think the expectation is that it's going to be a fairly active Rule 5. I mean, the last couple of years, it feels like, you know, it's 10 to 15 guys who get picked. I have a feeling this might be more like, I think there was one 3 or 4 years ago where there were 19 players drafted. I don't know that it's necessarily a good Rule 5 class or a deep Rule 5 class, but I do feel that teams are going to be active on Thursday morning, and we're going to see 15 to 20 players selected in the major league phase. There's been a little bit of buzz on players. I think the buzz on players actually gets generated more by us and by Jonathan Mayo at MLB.com and national media like the two of us who cover the Rule 5 and throw out some names. That really is my feel, is that that's where the buzz kind of starts. There are a few older scouts who you do, I think we all try to talk to, who've been around these winter meetings. Those are the guys where you end up picking up some of the Rule 5 buzz from. But to my knowledge, the buzz that I've picked up is that there is a sense that it's going to be active, JJ. And I think we all have our personal cheese ball players. And then, you know, we're getting ready to publish, you know, number two, version 2.0. Hopefully more successful than Spinal Tap's version 2.0 of our Rule 5 draft preview. But we can just dive right into some of that. I'll throw out a name. The most intriguing name so far to me is a name that Ben Badler has picked up on. So naturally he's a Latin American player. But let's start off there with Jose Dominguez of the Dodgers organization. 22 years old. We've got scouting reports of Jose Dominguez sitting 96 to 98. You know, touching a lot of 100s during the year. He finished the year very strong. He got promoted to Double A after being in the Midwest League for most of the season. And in Double A, especially his last two outings of the year, he faced Birmingham, the White Sox affiliate, and he struck out 9 guys in 3 2/3 innings. So 11 batters, 11 outs, 9 of them by strikeouts, didn't allow any runs. So that's really, you know, a strong finish of the year. to my knowledge, he's not pitching winter ball. But then there's this further complicating factor with Dominguez. So right off the bat, JJ, he fits the profile of the Reiner Cruises of the world, or the, you know, longer ago. So who was the pitcher who had the big year for the Braves, who was an extra Rule 5 pick? I'm blanking on his name. He had one good year as a starter. Jorge Sosa, is that it?
Yeah, the converted outfielder.
That's him. So Jorge Sosa was a Rule 5 pick. So the Latin American pitchers, and the reason that I specify Latin American is guys who they sign at a young age and they take a while to develop, and they're usually not protected because they're in short season ball or low A, and they have big time arms. But most of the times, their teams don't protect them and think that they won't be able to stick
right
in the big leagues. But they make kind of adjustment in big league camp or the pitching coach, and they throw enough strikes to stick. So he fits that category. Then there's the complicating factor with Dominguez that he was suspended in November, right about a month ago. November 5th, I believe, is the day the press release is issued, that he was suspended for 25 games for a violation of the drug treatment program. Now, he did not get – there's no specification in that press release by MLB of what drug he took. And the speculation is – we haven't had this confirmed, but since we're on a podcast, I'm going to say speculation. The speculation is that he didn't take the test or his – you know, there's some complication with his test. So he's suspended for 25 games – not the regular 50-game suspension, and the wording of the suspension is a little bit different. So here's a guy with a drug suspension. He's barely pitched above Class A. He's not pitching winter ball. He's 22. He did have a 5-plus ERA in low Class A, nearly walked six guys per nine innings. So is he Archimedes Carmenero, the guy with the live arm a couple years ago who the Marlins didn't protect and we were all hot and bothered about at Rule 5 time? Or is he Jorge Sosa, or is he Reiner Cruz last year's picked by the Astros, who did stick in Houston on a 107-loss team and spent the whole year in the big leagues?
The likelihood is he's probably A. He's more of a Caminero, but that's, we talk about these because there's always the chance he can be a Jorge Sosa, and that's why it makes this interesting. I got another guy we're gonna, you know, he's gonna be in the write-ups also that kind of fits along those same lines. Yonata Ortega with the Rangers, pretty similar MO, although his fastball had kind of dropped off some in 2012, not as firm a stuff, but you're still talking when it's, you know, he's shown 94, 97 before. He's got a good splitter. He's also a guy who's got control problems. He did make it to, he's already pitched in Double A, so that's one thing kind of working for him. You know, he's not my pick to click, but when you were mentioning kind of the MO there, that's another guy who kind of fits that. Kind of to me,
yeah. No, he's an intriguing arm because he's 26. You know, he's older,
and he just signed with the Rangers as a minor league free agent. So the argument also against him is, if you really like this guy, you could go out and get him as a minor league free agent and not worry about the whole roster thing. So,
right, that does argue against him. But he's an intriguing name. He was definitely one that I, you know, where my ears were pricked up on. Just he's a guy that I'm going to ask about. But like you said, I mean, he's kind of similar. He's an older version of Jose Dominguez, and that here's a guy who has not thrown a lot of strikes in his minor league career outside of A-ball. But there's no denying the live arm, and was in the handbook, in the 2011 handbook, and the Diamondbacks top 20. So, there's two parts, I think, to any Rule 5 preview, JJ, at least in the Baseball America version of it. There's the guys who are intriguing, who you think might get picked, or the names that you hear scouts talk about. They usually don't talk about too many of them. Then there's the fun guys who you'd like to see picked. I wanted to ask you, who are some of the guys that you'd like to see picked? Because I know the one name, I wish he were healthy. If he were 100% healthy, I would really love to see this guy picked. But Pat Vendit, or Vendit, I never know how you pronounce his name. I think it's Vendit.
Right, because I remember however we pronounced it, we were told it was wrong when we talked to his dad. Or something like
that. Yeah, I think it's Vendit, but I mean, I think most people remember him as the, you might remember Pat from such roles as switch pitching and the 2008 All-America team. He was, All-American at Creighton, pitches with both arms, had a torn labrum in his right shoulder this year. And Pat has pitched a lot of winter ball in the past, and he's not pitching winter ball this year, which leads me to believe he's still not healthy from his labrum tear. I haven't talked to anyone about him, but that's a guy that I would love to see picked one year when he was healthy. see him in Major League camp and see what he can do because, as Matt Eddy has taught us, a platoon advantage is a very, very important advantage. And it would be a nice thing to have a lefty specialist who you could trust if you had a left, right, left, where you could bring in your left guy and get an inning out of him because he has the platoon advantage against both sides. Of course, you have to throw quality pitches from both sides, and the issue with him has always been that he's had below-average stuff. But the platoon advantage kind of makes up for that a little bit. So he to me, is one of the most intriguing players available. The health problem is obviously a problem, but this might not be his year to get picked. But until his career is over, I will look for Pat Vendit in the Rule 5 draft.
By the way, I'll edit this part out, but move your mic slightly away from your mouth. You're getting some pops on it.
Okay. All right.
But, no, I think, you know, I don't think he's going to get picked, but, yeah, I agree that he is definitely one of the most fascinating names who is out there for this. A guy who I think we've talked about that, that we do think will get picked. I understand in some ways the Red Sox basically at the end had to decide, okay, do you protect this guy or not? They did protect Josh Fields, former first-round pick of the Mariners. I would be, I guess, a little bit surprised if that guy's not picked because
– completely agree with you.
Because he has stuff, and it's not impractical to say, could that guy actually help you in a big league bullpen next year? I mean, not you could carry him, and then 2-3 years down the road, hopefully he could help you. He's a guy who you say, I mean, he pitched in AAA and had some success last year. You could say, okay, if he has a good spring, that he could be the rare Rule 5 guy who's actually kind of treated like a normal guy, with the only downside of a lot of times you want a little bit more flexibility with your relievers to be able to bring them up and down. You wouldn't have that flexibility with Fields. But besides that, he could be a useful 6th-7th inning guy who could do that, and it's not like you're having to stretch to project him to do that.
Yeah, I think he's a great name to bring up because he has track record, he has pedigree, AAA experience, and he finally had some success and really made some progress. I think one of the reasons I don't know if he's under the radar or not, but why we don't talk about him as much as maybe we used to. When he was at Georgia, we talked about this guy a lot. I mean, he was a second-round pick as an eligible sophomore in 2007, didn't sign with the Braves, came back the next year, helped your alma mater and Jim's alma mater get to the College World Series finals where they lost to Fresno State, but he was outstanding for Georgia, first-round pick of the Mariners. And then, he was that tail end, like we've written about, of like that little period, a glorious period for college relief pitchers where they were first-round picks from about 2003 to 2008.
I got to be honest with you. He was one who, watching him in the College World Series that year, again, hashtag not a scout, I watched him and was like, I don't think this guy has a chance. And the reason I said that was that he was a guy who was extremely effective in college, but had no command at all, I felt like. I don't know what you thought, but no command at all, and control was kind of a question. But his stuff was good enough that he could get guys to chase out of the zone in college, and it was like, that's probably not going to work. He has toned some of those issues down, because if he didn't, I still wouldn't think he'd have a chance. But that was always – I was never a Josh Fields guy, and now I'm saying, hey, this guy should be taken in the Rule 5, but which is funny how
– I think that's fair. I mean, I liked him a little better than you did, but there's always been effort in his delivery. There's always been a lot of moving parts. He's not a big guy. So it's not a J.J. Cooper delivery. So if you're on Facebook.
That's an effortful delivery.
We had a good laugh about this last night, J.J., because Jim is not on Facebook, Jim Callis. So because Jim's not on Facebook, he'd never seen the video. So if you're on Facebook – first of all, go like Baseball America on Facebook. We got about 12,000 likes on Facebook, maybe more than that. Second of all, once you like us on Facebook, go back to our timeline to December 2011, and that's what pops up is the video that I shot of you with my iPhone pitching last year in the quote unquote pitching at the. You get to see my stabbing arm action that Marty Wolliver panned and said he would never sign me. And then you get to see your inadvertent Luis Tiant / Gene Garber impersonation.
No. Give me a little credit. There's some advert. It was somewhat advert.
Okay. There was some intent there. But it's good. So there was a J.J. Cooper effort level delivery from Josh Fields, but there was a lot of effort and all those moving parts. And, you know, he was a little guy generating all that energy. But I did talk to, actually, to Arnie Baylor, the Pawtucket manager, late in the year. You know, I was talking International League top prospects, and they were in Durham for the AAA championship game, and he cited Josh Fields and the improvement that he'd made. The direction of the plate was better. So all that energy is now going in one direction instead of multiple directions. So, but the other issue, the one that I think you hit on, as an amateur, and you and I have talked about this a lot in recent podcasts, as an amateur, he did not have to throw his breaking ball for strikes. His calling card was his breaking ball. I mean, he had velocity, but a lot of guys have velocity. But the calling card for him was that at that level, as an amateur, it was a plus fastball and a plus power breaking ball. But in pro ball, nobody chased, and he didn't make the adjustment basically until age 27. So here in his fifth professional season, he's made the adjustment better. He's still not a strike thrower, but he has shown an increased ability to throw his breaking ball for strikes, or at least something approximating the strike zone, as opposed to a pitch that right out of his hand, hitters don't respect its ability to find the strike zone. So to me, that's the big difference for Josh Fields, and I do think he's one of the more likely players to get pop. So
let me ask that leads to an interesting question, because we talk about this a lot, but it is one of the differences. If you say what's the difference between the majors and a guy who's having success, especially in A ball, but even Double A AA and Triple A, it's that can you generate swings and misses in the zone? Kind of with that, I'm trying to think of, can you think of a guy, a pitcher, who has a swing and miss pitch that's an out of the zone swing and miss pitch that is effective at the big league level? Because really, the only thing I can come up with is that if you have a really good split, I'll give you that. Because you can throw it in a way that looks like a fastball. So, like Nomo, Hideo Nomo at his best had a swing, you know, it was a swing and miss pitch that was a ball pretty much every time, but you still had to swing at it because you thought it was a fastball.
Yeah, I think Hiroki Kuroda, actually, I was just talking to somebody about this the other day, that had the similarities between Hiroki Kuroda and Hideo Nomo in that way, in that like Nomo, he gets hitters to chase. And I think the key there is, and this is what Daisuke Matsuzaka did not do, they commanded the fastball. So when you have, and this is, again, something that Josh Fields does not do, if you command the fastball and hitters have to respect your fastball command and that you fill up the strike zone with your fastball, and then there's a pitch that's coming out of your hand that looks like a fastball coming out, they have to make that split-second decision. And if they read fastball and they get split, they're going to chase. And that's the difference. You have to have a pitch. So there's so much that goes into that. You know, are you throwing all your pitches out of the same release point in the same slot? You know, are you repeating that release point? That is, I guess, honestly, that's really deception, mm-hmm. because hitters can't tell by your release point what pitch is coming out. And, you know, like what they talk about with Barry Zito, where his curveball, where at a point where his curveball was coming out, well, the first thing it did was go up. So that was a tell for hitters that they knew the curveball was coming. And at that point in his career, the first adjustment he made was he relied more on the changeup. But then when you lose fastball velocity, everything kind of cascaded for him. But yeah, there's a lot of that's, to me, that's a tell. And I think fastball command is one thing that would make make hitters chase your other secondary pitches more often. But that would be a great project for any of our listeners who like to play with the cloud and like to play with pitch effects, to find a pitcher who gets hitters to chase out of the strike zone. I would love to see that research. Who's getting hitters to chase the most? That would be something I would be interested in finding. I have a feeling that it's not going to be a former Rule 5 draft pick.
Yeah, I feel safe with that. That was clearly a diversion. But
yeah, I really do think that's a big part of the tale for Josh Fields. One other. We also mentioned earlier, JJ, you mentioned Ortega. The good farm systems are often the ones that we see get rated in the Rule 5. One thing that Matt Eddy and I noticed a lot was Yankees players who've been the Yankees get rated in the Rule 5 pretty frequently. But you know, just looking at the Rangers and their eligibles list, you mentioned Ortega. Do you feel like the Rangers, is there an organization that you feel is going to get rated more often than another one in this Rule 5? Was there one when you were looking through the eligibles list, was there a team that you said, man, they've got a lot of guys who could get popped?
I can't say anyone that jumped out as like, man, there's like four or five. There's like, because taking it from a BA window, the first thing we were looking at was, okay, so who are some guys we want to write up? And there were organizations where I could find two, three, four guys who I might want to write up. But then when I'd start kind of working on it, it'd be like, you know what? That guy's not going to get taken. I do the Royals list. And there are a number of Royals guys who I could see one or two of them getting taken. John Keck, who we wrote about, left-hander who, you know, can run it up 94, 95. Everyone saw him in the fall league. Patrick Keating, a reliever who's, you know, made it to double A and has been a guy, I mean, a fringy guy, but a guy, you know, he's made a couple of top 30s. Angel Baez, who's really interesting on there. He kind of fits the profile of the Latin American player who takes a while to develop. And so because of that, you roll the dice and put him, you know, he's available, but with great stuff. I mean, Baez will run it up 96, 97, 98. But the thing about it is that he just pitched in low A this year. So, and he really probably profiles as a reliever. Are you, that's where really a lot of this, like, because the guy who jumps out to me more than anyone for being available is Jesus Aguiar, who is a top 10 prospect in the Indians organization. That's not a good top 10, but he's still, I mean, this is a guy who's a top 10 prospect. But then you start looking at it and it actually makes some sense, because what team's going to take not ready first baseman?
Yeah, and it's actually intriguing, because I thought that three of the better names out there, as far as guys who are the most big league ready and would be easier to protect, are first baseman. We wrote about Aguiar, we wrote about Mark Krause, and we wrote about Chris McGinnis, the Arizona Fall League MVP. But I'm glad that you brought up Aguiar, JJ, because that kind of reminds me, the Indians, like we just said, this is not, in our minds, a fertile farm system, not a system that has a ton of depth. But it is a farm system that left some players unprotected. Aguiar was number 9 on their list. Giovanni Ursula and Elvis Araujo, I don't know how you pronounce his name. Araujo, I believe, is his last name.
Yeah.
I butchered that pronunciation, and I apologize to Elvis's family for that. But both those guys are in their top 30. Alex Monsalve, I think, was in their top 30. TJ McFarland, I think, was in their top 30. All these guys are unprotected. McFarland's had some upper levels success.
If I can make another digression, but this is a Rule 5 digression. We've talked about this. Matt Eddy's big into this. You can break the categories of guys who normally get taken into a couple of different categories. There's the control pitcher, who that's why he's available. TJ McFarland, who could, you know, a lot of cases, especially if you're lefty, TJ McFarland fits that very well, and that he's a lefty who, you know, who could work as a lefty reliever. So you got the control pitcher, you got the power pitcher who just isn't ready, which we've already talked about a couple of the guys like that. Then there's the middle infielder who, yeah, we could carry him as a utility infielder because he plays defense well.
The Mike Martinez.
Right.
Correlate here.
Right. You know, but so that's, you know, there's a variety. But sorry, as a digression. But TJ McFarland very much fits the lefty without great stuff, but who, you know, who throws enough strikes and has enough pitches to maybe get picked.
AJ, I think we kind of think that those guys don't get picked, but then you look at.
They do.
Look at last year, Terry Doyle goes second overall to the Twins. And, you know, I do our Twins top 30, and I just saw the Twins contingent walk by here on their way out of Delta Island, which is, I just love all the names of the places here at the Opryland. But you look at the Minnesota Twins, and they just traded Denard Span for Alex Meyer, which I think is a pretty intriguing trade. We could talk about that later if you'd
yeah.
like. I think it's a pretty intriguing trade, but obviously the Twins need pitching. They know they need pitching, and that trade was a good gamble for the Twins. And they but they didn't get a close to the majors pitcher. They got a pitcher who's never pitched out of A ball, but in terms of upside, has more upside probably than any pitcher in their organization. So I think it was a worthwhile risk for them to take. But you're still looking at the Twins. If you go to their MLB.com depth chart, you're still looking at a team that basically has three starters under contract on its 40-man roster for 2012 who have
That's
major league experience.
Not good.
And they're Liam Hendricks, Cole DeVries, and Scott Diamond. I mean, Liam Hendricks is a guy they like. He's been a top 10 prospect. He's also like 1-12 in the major leagues with an ERA near 6 in his career. Might be over 6. Cole DeVries is a guy who never made a top 30. A guy who, honestly, I think no one with the Twins would tell you they ever expected to be a guy who pitched as many innings in the big leagues as he did last year. And the last thing they would think to do is to make plans to have a team where Cole DeVries throws 180 innings in the major leagues. That is not the way they expect to win a championship. It's not even the way that they expect to, like, hold a place, you know. So this is an organization that I think, no matter what they do on the free agent market here, I think they're going to take a back-end starter. I think they're going to take somebody in the Rule 5 draft, and it's going to be one of these Rule 5, or it's going to be one of these back-end starters you're talking about. It's going to be a T.J. McFarland type, and I'll throw out a couple other names to you. I think it could be a guy like a Vidal Nuño, left-hander, thick-bodied left-hander who had a great year in the Yankees organization. He was at Trenton for the last 20 starts of the year. Talking with Yankees personnel, I probably should have made him best control in the handbook. I think I put Caleb Cotham, who was also Rule 5 draft eligible. Cotham I consider a little bit better prospect, but he's injury prone. Nuño is not injury prone. He's having a big winter ball with Zulia. He's got 19 strikeouts and 21 innings there. He's left-handed, but he was more effective against right-handed hitters than he was against left-handed hitters in the Eastern League, but he held both of them to a sub-700 OPS. He's got about a 3-1 strikeout-to-walk ratio. A lot of these things add up, and you throw in the fact that he threw like 140 innings in the regular season. Now he's thrown 20 more in winter ball. You're talking about a guy who's thrown 160 innings. It wouldn't be a crazy leap to think that he could throw 150 innings for you in the big leagues if he's having some success. You threw out McFarland. I'll throw out another durable body, starting pitching back-end guy. That's Nick Struck of the Cubs organization. He was their minor league pitcher of the year. Had 14-10 and like 155 innings at Double-A Tennessee. And then threw 11-12 more innings in the fall league. Didn't put up great numbers in the fall league, but what do I understand? You saw him throw the same three-pitch mix that you saw him throw in Double-A. Again, he's from the Terry Doyle playbook. I believe in the words of Peter Gammons, who would use the word old friend here, but an old friend of mine and a longtime personal cheat ball, Justin Fitzgerald, yet another back-end starter type. But if you're talking about – I'm not saying these guys are Joe Blanton because Joe Blanton has done it. But I've seen the Twins tied to Joe Blanton. And Joe Blanton's done in the big leagues, but it's possible that one of these guys could, especially if you're rebuilding, could be a close equivalency of a Joe Blanton. And I'm looking at Justin Fitzgerald as a guy who pitched 165 innings this year in Double-A, then went and made 5 more starts in winter ball, so he's over 180, close to 190 innings for the year. A guy in 165 Double-A innings gave up 8 home runs. Last year, in 140-some innings in Double-A, he gave up 7 home runs. He was Rule 5 eligible last year. He's Rule 5 eligible this year. The Giants do not value him as a prospect. Some scouts, again, it's a back-end profile, but I've always liked Justin. He was a closer at UC Davis on a team I liked. And to me, this is a guy who's shown that he can fill up the strike zone, keep the ball in the ballpark, and keep his team in a game. I think there's value to that. And to me, Justin Fitzgerald is greater than Cole DeVries. So, to me, he's a guy that a team like the Twins that has some real questions about their 2013 Major League rotation should take a long, hard look at.
I'll throw two other guys out like that there's a lot of guys that we could throw into this category of the guy who's had some success, who knows how to pitch, who doesn't have great stuff category. But two Phillies guys, Austin Hyatt and Julio Rodriguez. Julio Rodriguez didn't have a great year last year, was really the most effective pitcher on a very talented staff in Clearwater 2 years ago. But he's one of those guys, has a variety of pitches, generally knows how to pitch. Austin Hyatt, I would say maybe, you know, if you were grading out the stuff, might be a little bit better than Rodriguez. He's another guy who's very intriguing for those, you know, reasons. Has some upper level minor league experience. He could be a guy who, you know, you see fitting with a team like the Twins if they're trying to find a guy to come to camp and have an outside shot of being that fifth starter.
And you know, JJ, both those guys, even though Hyatt's strikeout rate backed up this year as he got his first AAA time and he kind of got hammered in the International League, but both Rodriguez and Hyatt, what stands out to me is they both have career strikeouts per nine of above nine strikeouts per inning. They both average more than a strikeout an inning, and it's both, you know, for Rodriguez, I believe it's 403 career innings, and for Hyatt, it's 501 career innings. That's a long track record of missing some bats in professional baseball.
And they're both pretty durable, too.
Correct. So I would find complicating factor is if you draft Julio Rodriguez, I can almost guarantee you, as worlds collide here, I can almost guarantee you he will be on Puerto Rico's World Baseball Classic roster. He will be looked to as a significant starter for Puerto Rico. He was their number one starter during the 2011 World Cup. He was also a significant starter for them in the 2010 World Cup qualifier, which was played in Puerto Rico. So Javier Vasquez, whom we discussed last week before I came here, is going to pitch winter ball in Puerto Rico, tuning up for the World Baseball Classic. But Puerto Rico does not have a deep roster of pitchers, and Julio Rodriguez is going to be part of that. So if you rule five Julio Rodriguez, you have to know that he's going to start getting hot early because of the World Baseball Classic.
That's true. That's true. World Baseball Classic affects the Rule 5 draft, potentially. But I do think, though, that there's, again, that fits that category there. The category, you know, which what that happens is that, so we see first baseman. I do think some of the best guys in this Rule 5 draft, some of the best available players are first baseman. The real question comes down to, will any of them get picked? Because to me, you only pick you like it a little better if it's a first baseman outfielder. Mark Krause gives you a little bit more flexibility there. But if it's primarily a first baseman, it's really hard to carry those guys as a bench guy. So you only take one of those guys if you think there's a chance that he could even compete for a starting job or contribute to DH or something like that. That's why, to me, the guy who's I like the best out of that group is Chris McGinnis, because I think he could hold his own in the big leagues and be a productive player in 2013. I don't think there's a whole lot of massive upside there, but he'll get on base, have a little bit of power. Is any of those guys jump out to you, or, you know, of that type, do you think it's just going to be a lot of guys who don't get picked?
I think most of them are not going to get picked, but I do think one of them will be, and I do think McGinnis is the guy because he was so good in the fall league. And he does have track record of drawing consistent walks, and he's starting to tap into some of that power. So, you know, Krause, I think, is interesting. And the Astros, I prefer McGinnis out of those first base options. It does make me think of the Astros. Krause makes me think of the Astros because, first of all, this is a team, well, I do their top 30, and thank God it's done. So there's that. Number two, it's an organization that just carried two guys last year in the Rule 5
and
with Reiner Cruz and Marwin Gonzalez.
And an organization that still in 2013 is not exactly going to be battling for a World Series spot.
Correct. There's the indications have been that they are going to be active in this Rule 5, and they pick first. We need to go ahead and post the Rule 5 draft order. But the Astros pick first in the Rule 5, so let's look at the Astros. At first of all, they need a designated hitter. They don't have a DH. They are in the American League for the first time. That would have made me think they would keep Mark Krause, but maybe they have DH.
But also, maybe, again, the reality of it is that's a guy who you might win that risk. Because
correct,
those are the kind of guys who don't get picked as much.
Correct, and make him earn that spot, you know, in big league camp. But there isn't there's no obvious first baseman in Houston. Brett Wallace has had his opportunity. If there are there any center fielders that you look at here, JJ? Because Brandon Barnes finished the regular season as the Astros center fielder.
He's more of a fourth outfield type, but Josh Fellhauer with the Reds.
Yep.
I'll give you two Reds guys. Felix Perez with the Reds, former Cuban who came over a couple years ago, and Fellhauer. Both of them are fourth, fifth outfield types, but the reality is just that the Astros were fielding at times. They didn't have many fourth, fifth outfield types on the big league roster. They had sixth and seventh outfield types. But Fellhauer can play all three positions, gets on base, can hit a little bit, had a good year at AA last year. That's a guy, again, if we're throwing out names, who there's some that's the guy who jumps out to me, because there aren't a whole lot of guys who you say, okay, that guy can play every day center field in the big leagues and hit. If you can, you're not available in the Rule 5 very often.
Exactly. I mean, that's a to me, it's not a top-level premium position, but it is kind of a premium position, and you don't usually see those filled via the Rule 5 draft. But, yeah, I did not see in my perusal of the the Rule 5 eligibles list, I did not see an obvious center fielder, and I'm looking at the Astros 40-man roster. I almost wonder if Chaechuan Lin, even though he's not primarily a center fielder, not always a center fielder, he might be their pick to click in center field. He's on their 40-man roster. I think they got him a waiver claim from the Red Sox. I mean, but that's a team that has a lot of needs, JJ. And last year they really did have a middle infield need that was a crying need. And that led them to draft Marwin Gonzalez, and he was fungible for them. He played okay, for them at the big league level. They still had to go out and make some moves. So the teams that are at the top of this, that are picking toward the top of the Rule 5, the Astros pick first, the Cubs, the Rockies, the Twins, then Cleveland. I think you're going to see some of those teams, picking guys for some need. And Cleveland, I think it's interesting. Obviously, last year, Cleveland thought it was going to contend. They did contend for half the season. It sounds like Cleveland's going to blow things back up again. But most of these teams we're talking about toward the top, Cubs, the Cubs are really the only exception. I guess the Twins have a large payroll, but they look like they're trying to pare that down. And the first six picks, most of their teams have a lot of needs and also are trying to stretch payroll, like the Rockies, like the Miami Marlins. Then you have the Red Sox at seven. I mean, the Yankees have been fairly active in the Rule 5. Do you expect a team like the Red Sox that has a lot of money but also lost 93 games and has a lot of need, do you expect them to be active in the Rule 5 draft? I particularly don't myself.
I don't, but here's the one thing I'll throw out there, which is the cost of this is so low that the reason I think the Red Sox probably won't, for one, is that their 40-man's pretty tight. That's, to me, we've reached the point. The cost of the Rule 5 pick is immaterial completely, because you're really talking about $25,000, and that is money lost in the seat cushions for these teams, for every team, Marlins included. But the one thing that is tough is you are talking about that's a 40-man roster spot, and those are valuable. More valuable for some teams than others, depending on where your farm system is at that point. But the reason I wouldn't be surprised to see the Red Sox not too involved is that I don't think that they necessarily – they're going to have, especially when they get done making the moves that they're going to make, I think they're going to have a very full 40-man. And you take a pick, that's like that guy's on your 40-man, and at least until mid-March when you decide to send them back. So
I think they're at 9 right now after signing Mike Napoli. And the thing is, I actually thought that they were going to be active because McGinnis, I should have mentioned this earlier, they originally drafted Chris McGinnis. I think they liked him. I don't remember how the Rangers got him. Must have been some kind of trade. Of course, Baseball America transaction history can tell me that for subscribers. And he was traded in the Jared Saltalamacchia trade with right-hander Roman Mendez. So that's how the Rangers got him for Saltalamacchia. Saltalamacchia, obviously in Boston. I think McGinnis could be a guy that, you look at Boston, and they traded Adrian Gonzalez. James Loney's a free agent. right now their first baseman looks like it's Mike Napoli, who obviously they didn't – I don't think they paid Mike Napoli $13 million just to play first base, but they already had five catchers on the 40-man roster when they signed Mike Napoli, and they have Big Poppy. So it's not like there's a ton of DH time sitting there for Mike Napoli. So to me, if you're signing Mike Napoli and you're Boston, you're doing that with an eye to him playing a lot of first base.
Oh, yeah. Primarily, he's a first baseman. He's going to be a first baseman primarily for them.
So it does make me wonder if there's a guy who you draft to be the other first baseman, if it's a Rule 5 guy who can caddy for him defensively and play first base when Mike Napoli gets some of those catcher bats. Because I just saw, I say this in an endearing fashion, but the insane Rangers blogger, Jamie Newberg, loves Mike Napoli. I sent out an email today about his love for Mike Napoli and how he's sorry to see him, the Rangers, lose Mike Napoli. And one of the stats that jumped out in Jamie's ode to Napoli was how much better he hit when he caught than when he didn't catch. I think he hit 186, albeit with a 70 or so OPS, when he played first base or DH, and he hit better when he caught. So, I could see the Red Sox at 7 being a team that goes out for a first baseman kind of to be a caddy to Napoli. But the point is, the Rule 5 is interesting and intriguing. It's very unlikely, JJ, that there's another Joachim Soria or Dan Uggla out there in this year's class.
No, and the reality is that, as we've talked about, the Rule 5 has been purposely gutted.
Yeah.
They added an extra year of protection before you're eligible for the Rule 5. Well, what that's done is, by the time a college player is eligible for the Rule 5, you pretty much know what they are. Fair to say?
Yeah, by this time, the Dennis Green rule is in effect. They are who we thought they were
The only ways I would say that may not be true is for a conversion guy.
That's a good point.
Like, again, I do the Royals. If Brett Eibner falls on his face again in 2013 as a hitter, and they say going into 14, you know what, you're going to pitch. Well, at that point, then you're talking about a guy who's Rule 5 eligible. You have to make a decision on whether he's Rule 5, protect him on the 40 man or whatever, and you don't know what he can do as a pitcher. But when you have 4 years as a college player under their belts, if they're not, a pitcher is now a hitter, or a hitter is now a pitcher, there's not a whole lot that's not known at that point.
I think that's a great point, and that's why Josh Fields is a surprising guy to be included, because usually jokers like him don't make on these lists. I've exhausted my Rule 5 inventory of things to talk about, JJ. Unless there's something else, Rule 5 eligible, is there anything else you want to talk about winter meetings related in there?
But, no, there is one other thing I do want to talk about. I think if you look at that Denard Span Alex Meyer trade, that reaches the level of worthy of comment. You're talking about a big league regular traded for a relatively premium prospect. I like the trade kind of from both sides. I really like it from the national side, because I think what the Nationals have done a very good job, and me and you talked about this in the office when the deal went down, it's hard for teams to properly time the transition from being buyers to sellers,
right,
when it comes to prospects. And I feel like that the Nationals did that about as well as anyone has in recent years, in that they made that transition last offseason, and they paid a price. I mean, they sent off a number of good prospects, but they were the best farm system in our mind in baseball before those trades. So you look at that and you say, yeah, that worked out pretty well. They realized when they were playoff ready at the right time. And now what they're probably going to do for the next couple of years is primarily going to be using these guys to kind of fill the holes like this. And I don't think there's a better way to fill a hole than to trade a very good pitching prospect, but one that's still got some significant risk to him, for a guy who fills a very dire need for the Nationals.
Yeah, because from the Nationals standpoint, it's a great deal, I think, because you get a center fielder, which they wanted. You move Bryce Harper to a corner, which is, I think, better for him in the long run. you have Michael Morris go back to first base where he hurts you less. I do think they lose Adam LaRoche, which will be a problem for them because he's a power left-handed bat. I think Span gives them a true leadoff guy. Harper becomes their true power left-handed bat. I think this does put a little bit more pressure on Bryce Harper because you look around the rest of that lineup, there's not really another big left-handed bat in there. Really, Danny Espinosa, is their other left-handed bat, basically, a switch hitter who has any power because Span is the only other left-handed hitter in their everyday lineup. So it does unbalance them a bit, but I think Span was a player they had targeted, and they go get him, and they didn't have to give up a big leaguer to get him. Today, as I'm recording this, they signed Dan Heron to kind of replace Edwin Jackson, and I would rather have Dan Heron than Edwin Jackson. That's an easy call. So their rotation is fortified. And to me, JJ, the clock is ticking on the Nationals, and I think they know it. They have to win while Steven Strasburg and Bryce Harper, before they hit the free agent market, because they're Boris clients. And nobody knows better than Mike Rizzo that Boris clients are not going to give you, just because they've given truckloads of money to Scott Boris does not mean that Scott Boris will reciprocate and that Steven Strasburg and Bryce Harper will not test the free agent market when they become free agents. Those are two guys. There's not going to be a press conference 4 years from now where Bryce Harper says, I want to be a National for life, and he signs an Evan Longoria deal. That ain't happening.
One thing I'll say is that clock is ticking, but that clock is still right now 5 years away.
I agree.
I mean, that's a long clock.
They're still in win now mode. They're in win mode while they have those two guys under controlled contracts so they can spend a lot of money on everybody else. Okay. I think it's just undeniable that they do have a window of 4 to 5 years where they have Strasburg and Harper both under team control. But that's it. Those guys are not going to be there for 15 years. They're just not. They're both
actually.
Hold on.
We don't know that they won't be there for 15 years. What we know is if they are there for 15 years, it'll almost assuredly be because on the free agent market, they re-signed with the Nationals for a massive deal.
And that just I just don't see that happening. I honestly
I don't see
don't
both
see
of them. I see they can do one. I don't think you can do two.
And that's it. The what makes the Nationals is those two guys. I mean, they have great other players. Ryan Zimmerman is a very good player. They have, obviously, Gio Gonzalez. They have other very good players. But what makes the Nationals dynamic is Strasburg and Harper. And they are, and they traded a Boris client in Alex Meyer. That's an organization that Mike Rizzo has a long history with Boris clients. And Scott Boris obviously has a pipeline into the owner there in Ted Lerner. And that's how you give 7 years, $120 million to Jason Worth. So I'm on the Boris tangent. I didn't mean to get on that tangent. But let's talk about what it means for the Twins. I'm still debating this for the prospect handbook. Kyle Gibson was number 4 on the Twins' top 10. Kyle Gibson will be 26 next year. He's 25. He's not pitching the major leagues. He did pitch well in the Arizona Fall League. That said, he pitched about 60 innings this year.
And when you say pitched well, I mean, it's the Arizona Fall League, so everything, but he was a above 5 ERA.
Right, but I think he was second in the league or led the league in strikeouts.
Right.
28 strikeouts, 20 innings. He probably had a league average ERA, and his first two outings there were outstanding. Subsequently, not as good because he did give up more runs. But 92 to 94 with the fastball. A couple of pro scouting directors who confirmed those numbers for me with what he pitched as far as his fastball velocity in the fall league. The changeup was as plus as it's ever been. The fastball was plus. The slider has been plus in the past. So the action and the shape on the slider were good. His feel for the pitch and command were not as good in the fall league as they had been pre-injury. This is a guy who's always thrown a plus slider. So you hope that maybe the arm action didn't lengthen and maybe he lost that feel for the slider permanently. But, that's something to kind of TBA, TBD, to be decided when he has more innings. But that's the Twins' best pitching prospect kind of by a mile. Who would you take? Alex Meyer, who really had an explosive season in A-ball, threw more strikes than he has when you look at his overall track record going back to his 3 years at Kentucky, but it's a 6'9" pitcher he's probably never going to have precise command. Probably always going to have below average command, but maybe he has 50, 55, 60 control. But he has bigger stuff than Kyle Gibson. He's younger, and he's never had Tommy John. JD, I'm putting you on the spot. I can tell you how I rank them, but who would you take, Alex Meyer or Kyle Gibson?
Probably Meyer. And the reason I say that is that Gibson has, at this point, as you pointed out, I mean, he's a little bit of an older prospect in his pitcher, so I'm not as worried about that. But also the reality is that he's got a significantly worse injury history than Meyer.
Yeah, I took Meyer,
right,
that'll be reflected in the handbook.
And by that I mean, go past the Tommy John. There's been a number of years where with him, with Gibson, it's like, okay, well, he's got this that's bothering him.
Well, in fairness to Kyle Gibson, it was a forearm strain that affected him his draft year, and that forearm strain made teams shy away from him because they thought that meant future
right.
Tommy John surgery.
Right.
And it did. So
I think
they're related.
Right.
So I almost kind of count that as one injury.
And if you want to, you can count that as one injury. But the reality of that, because of that, Meyer's not that far behind him developmentally, even though he's significantly younger than Gibson with better stuff. I feel like if you're making the argument for Gibson, I mean, I can make that argument pretty easily. You probably could too, because you could say, hey, here's a guy. We just talked about the Twins rotation. This guy's going to pitch in the big leagues in 2013. If he doesn't, something's wrong. Because
if he doesn't, it's because the Twins draft two of these innings eaters that we're talking about in the Rule 5, and Kyle Gibson has some kind of physical setback. To me, if Kyle Gibson doesn't exhaust his – he's either going to exhaust his rookie eligibility in 2013 and not be in the handbook, or he's going to have a crappy 2013. And if he's back in the handbook, he won't be back in the top 10 because he'll be 26 and still not a big leaguer. And then what is he? I mean, it's really – this is the last year Kyle Gibson is going to be in the top 10. And hopefully for Kyle Gibson – it's the last year for him in the handbook because he needs to get on with his career, you know.
Right, and Meyer's is a higher risk guy, but I think also it's fair to say Meyer is a guy who, ceiling wise, is significantly higher than Gibson, because if it all comes together, it could be a pretty special package.
Yeah, so I liked the trade for both teams. I think if you're a Twins fan, you're taking more risk. But they have to. And this opens up to the – I think maybe we talked about this, JJ, but it just, again, goes back to the Twins philosophy that Mike Radcliffe has talked about, that when push comes to shove at the top of a draft, they lean toward the hitter. And I think that also holds true internationally, that when push comes to shove, they go toward the hitter. And I think it's funny. I got some questions in the Twins chat. And I get this on Twitter, too, where Twins fans say, oh, we can't develop hitters. If we don't develop power hitters, look at how they let go of Big Poppy. I just think that's just so silly because the Twins, I mean, even last year, Trevor Plouffe hit 20-plus home runs for them, and he's Trevor Plouffe, for crying out loud. But they've developed Maurer. They've developed Morneau. They've developed Jason Kubel, Wilson Ramos. Michael Kadire had a nice, long, productive big league career. Span, Revere, they've developed all kinds of hitters. Hitters ain't the problem for the Twins. It's the pitching that's broken down, and the fact that they haven't drafted, signed, developed a homegrown pitcher since 2006 draft, where Anthony Slama was a 06 draftee and signed as a fifth-year senior draft and follow in 07. That's the problem. So when you have this gap, this developmental hole, you have to make deals to make trades to fill in. The Royals are doing the same thing. I mean, when you have a developmental hole, you have to go out and get Ervin Santana and trade for him and assume an eight-figure contract.
Well,
so
that's the interesting thing to me, is that the Twins and the Royals came into the offseason in very similar situations here, in that both of them had gaping holes in their rotation. I think that's fair to say on both parts. It's be interesting to see. The Royals' approach has been very much to get it all – they want to have that all kind of taken care of, if not by the end of the winter meetings, then by mid-December, it seems like, at the latest.
Right.
And the Twins have been taking the opposite approach, which is they're kind of letting the kind of everything settle out, and then they're going to make their moves. Because really, they haven't done much of anything to really upgrade their rotation yet, have they?
And I mean, I know that Terry Ryan was quoted that when Scott Baker, former Twins right-hander, was signed by the Chicago Cubs, his quote was, well, that's not because we didn't pursue him. We pursued Scott Baker. We wanted to re-sign him, but he chose to sign with the Cubs. So that was a setback for them. I think most of their targets, their early targets, have just signed elsewhere, and that's why you see them connected to a guy like a Joe Blant in these rumor central. So they know what their problem is. I think the other issue for the Twins is even though they've made some changes, I believe that their front office feels a little less pressure to win now, despite the fact they've had back-to-back 100.
I agree with you there. I think that's probably the biggest difference.
And that's the biggest difference. I think the Royals realize that Dayton Moore and company, if they don't show progress this year, as we talked about in the AL Central podcast, if they don't win 80-plus games this year, or in your mind, more than that, that they are going to lose their job. And I don't know that the Twins feel quite that same pressure. But honestly, I think the Twins aren't that far away from that same boat because since old man Polad passed away, the younger Polads in charge of the team are a lot more aggressive. They've spent a lot more money on the major league roster, and they've had less success, obviously, the last 2 years. So, but I do think the Twins – I honestly think the Twins tried to get a more major league-ready pitcher for Denard Span and decided that the upside of Meyer was more attractive to them than the same old Twins pitcher, the back-of-the-rotation guy they could get. But that's their mentality. Their mentality is they can find starting pitchers. They can trade for pitchers. It's hard to find stars in the draft who are position players. So it's basically the anti-Dick Tidrow philosophy, in which Dick Tidrow has always said, I can always go find a hitter. We got to go out and find some pitchers. And for most of my time at BA, I thought the Twins approach was the better approach because they'd been a much more consistent winner at the big league level. But when you throw Buster Posey into the mix, all of a sudden the Giants have 2 World Series championships in 3 years. When you mix in an impact bat like him and Pablo Sandoval that they developed with all the homegrown pitching that they have accumulated over the last decade. So right now that Dick Tidrow approach is looking a lot better.
Yeah, and now I'll ask you that you kind of touched on this, but I'll put you on the spot. Twins have had 2 bad years in a row. Do you think they should feel more urgency than they do to kind of, or is that a realistic assessment? Because I think also at the same time, it is a realistic assessment to look at this Twins team and say, there's not a move or two that they can make to contend in 2013.
Well, I think I'm of two minds on that. Part of me says they should still try to contend in 2013 because, A, the American League Central is the Ukraine of divisions. It is weak. 88 wins won it last year. Second of all, I don't know, even with the Tigers, their fearsome middle of their order, how much better is that than the Twins of Maurer, Willingham, and Morneau? I mean, even Morneau backed up last year. I wouldn't shock me to put it in J.J. Cooper parlance if Morneau had a dead cat bounce season.
Yeah.
And one more big year. They gave up Denard Span. They have center fielders galore, and I'm not a huge Ben Revere fan, but I also don't think that Aaron Hicks is that far away. I think while they have Maurer under contract, they could still put enough young homegrown jokers around him to have a very good lineup going forward. They're going to be, I think, a team that's going to score some runs. So that would be the argument, and basically you really need to get that one or two pitchers that are hard to find, obviously, but I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility to contend. That said, I lean more toward blow it up. I lean more toward, with all the money coming into the game, Joe Maurer's contract is not as onerous as it maybe looked like last year when he was having a difficult year in 2011 and had the injury issues and hit 280 or whatever he hit and just wasn't Joe Maurer. I think now that Joe Maurer has shown that he could be Joe Maurer again and you look around at teams that are trying to retool. I'm looking right in the American League East at the Yankees, who just lost Russell Martin, Red Sox, who do have five catchers, but have expressed interest in Joe Mauer in the past. But honestly, JJ, I'm looking at teams like that, even though the Yankees say they want to come down. Joe Mauer fits the Yankees like a glove. They don't have a catcher. That's a park where I think he would throw more power. He's only had the 1 year where he hit more than double figures in home runs. I mean, that's a team he could go to and hit more home runs. To me, when you're the Yankees and your goal is to win World Series championships every year, Joe Mauer would help them win a World Series championship in the short term with a older roster. And it might be the kind of thing where they have to move out a larger contract, Curtis Granderson first, to make room for Joe Mauer. But I'm the 20th move Joe Mauer in that contract, and if you can get a large haul in return for Joe Mauer. So I could see where they could, if they could make smaller moves to get really just fungible former, you know, old style Twins pitching, I think their offense could be, has the potential to be dynamic. So I could see if they go that route, I think it's sensible. I would see what you could get for Joe Mauer and see if you can rebuild.
Well, before we wrap up, I do have one other question. Since you are at the winter meetings, try to describe a little bit kind of the it's different in every city depending on where it is located. But you know, kind of to wrap this up, to people who haven't been to the winter meetings, kind of if you would just describe it a little bit to people, kind of what's going on and kind of what, you know, it. I think one of the things that, that stands out to me is that it's as important as it is for baseball. The thing that jumps out is that most of these teams are actually sequestered in their suites, and it's not something where you're seeing, you know, okay, this GM's huddling with this GM over here in the corner as much as it is, you know, okay, we're going to come over to your suite, you'll come over to ours. But it's kind of done behind closed doors more than actually, you know, in the open, I guess, which the first time I was there, it surprised me how little you saw of the front office officials during the day. But describe to people what the winter meetings is like a little bit, I guess.
Well, the romance of the winter meetings, I think, JJ, is the old story about Roland Heeman. I think the winter meetings were in Hawaii that year where he put out a table and had a sign on the table that it said, open for business, you know. Let's trade. I forget who he was the general manager at the time.
White Sox, wasn't it?
White Sox.
I think it was, and I think that was a very Vecchian thing to do.
Exactly. And, you know, Roland's here and was at the luncheon yesterday, and it's Scout of the Year banquet's coming up tomorrow. But they give the awards Monday during the minor league banquet where we give our minor league our Organization of the Year award. But seeing so there's the romance of that idea that teams are swashbuckling, making deals, swapping players left and right. And like you said, that really only happens in their hotel rooms. And you know so there's that part of it. You do still see, especially here in the Biodome, here at Opryland, which is basically like four or five little hotels, not little, four or five hotels, all interconnected in this internal, like I had said, Biodome. I mean, there's just a lot of trees in here. There's a skylight, so we can see the sun, sort of, outside. You kind of get a sense of what the weather's like. And there's all these walkways, tree-lined walkways when you're inside, so you can't always really see where you're going. You're walking past people, and most people are on their phone or texting as they're walking. There's a whole lot of that going on with the baseball people, especially the media. You really see a lot of media walking around. You see a ton of, you know, you see a lot of, I'll make a joke here at their expense, but it's met with respect. You see a lot of very small people walking around looking at their Blackberries and their iPhones. You know, the Tim Kirchens and but especially Buster and Ken Rosenthal, guys who work their asses off all week here, JJ. And I have so much respect for the national writers here, the John Haymans, the John Paul Morosis. I'm not trying to slight any of them, but all those guys, and obviously Peter Gammons, the work those guys put in here, texting, constantly emailing, texting, calling, meeting off to the side with front office people. That's one thing that really stands out to me is how hard those media guys work. But just how you can just spontaneously see a giant conglomerate. So you'll think there's nothing going on, and all of a sudden, boom, some piece of news will drop, and there's action and a flurry of activity. And if it happens to involve a New York team or Japanese player, the Japanese media is a little bit more swarmy than the North American media. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, it's fair. And the thing that stands out is also just again, I'm fascinated by the media landscape of Japanese media because the budget in the U.S. the travel budgets for newspapers have gone through the floor.
Right.
Does not seem like that's the case in Japan yet.
And there was a great article, and I forget where I read this. It might have been Jim Capel on ESPN. I think it was Jim Capel who wrote a really neat article about a friend of his, obviously, in the Japanese media. He's gotten to know over the years as that reporter has been – his beat is not to cover the Mariners. His beat is to cover Ichiro. And, of course, he's been in Seattle for a decade, and then Ichiro gets traded to New York, so this guy packs up –
this guy gets traded to New York, essentially.
Now this guy – his future is tied to Ichiro's future, and wherever Ichiro goes, he will go. So he's probably, he's probably got a horse in this race, but he has no influence on it. Talk about, this guy needs to go read Augie's book. Yeah, every time I think about this, I think about Augie Garrido on our old radio show talking about controlling your controllables. This guy has his controllables. Did not involve some things that are pretty important to him, like where you live. That's one very basic controllable that he has absolutely uncontrollable to him. It's mostly, most people have some say in where they live. He has no say. And media always fascinates me here. But to me, the overriding image and sound of the winter meetings is when it's 1 o'clock at night, and like it was last night, and I got done with a file for the prospect handbook and I wanted to celebrate with a frosty beverage. I texted the scout who I knew was here, found out where he was, and you go downstairs in whatever hotel you're in, wherever the winter meetings are, you go out in that lobby where there's usually a bar or several bars set up, and like last year you and I would go down there, and you go out into that lobby, and before you see it, you hear it. And you just hear that buzz of hundreds of people, almost all of the men. It's quite the sausage fest. You hear that buzz and you hear that hum of a bar with a lot of people talking baseball when everyone should be sleeping. And that writing sound and image of the winter meetings is that hum.
It is a hum. It's a buzz. That's a good way to describe it because it is.
You hear it before you see it and you build and you get into the middle of it and you're kind of always surprised at how loud it can get. There are a lot of people, a lot of beer, a lot of drinking, and nobody's acting foolish and out of control, at least not where I am. Maybe that happens at 3 or 4 in the morning. But in that giant lobby, that to me is the overriding image, is that sea of people and then that hum. So there goes Josh Boyd and A.J. Preller walking through the Delta Island Convention Center bridge. So I should let those guys go. That's a good sign that it's time to end the podcast, I think. When AJ and Josh have come out of their hotel rooms to stroll around, I think that means that it's time to go.
Well, John, thanks for joining us on this. Thanks everyone for the download here on the on this edition of the Baseball America podcast. If you're enjoying this, also by the time we have this posted up, we plan to have a Rule 5 preview, our second Rule 5 preview, get you ready for the Rule 5, which Thursday morning 10 a.m. I believe.
I think it's 9 a.m. Eastern time.
9 a.m. Eastern or 9 a.m. Central?
Wait a minute. This is an important fact. So let me just – I have the PDF in front of me about the Rule 5, December 6, 2012. Does it have the time? Hold on a minute.
This is fascinating podcasting.
This is a tremendous way to end the podcast. Rule 5 draft, 9 a.m. Thursday. So you were right, 10 a.m. Central, 9 a.m.
10 a.m. 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central.
Yep. So we are on Central Time here in Nashville. But yes, the Rule 5 draft will happen at 10 o'clock. So I'm sure we'll tweet the heck out of it, but we will have a post Rule 5 podcast as well. We'll probably just keep that one pretty tight because it's me and Ben Badler, and Ben is a man of fewer words than you or I. So we will have a quick podcast, and we'll see if we can even rope Jim Callis into the mix with some Rule 5 musings with that podcast here from Nashville. And then Thursday night, I'm also, JJ, going to try to rope Will Myers into a little podcast. Will Myers, our minor league player of the year, flying in here Thursday to accept his Baseball America Minor League Player of the Year award. So I'm excited to have Will here. We haven't had a Minor League Player of the Year winner come on in to the winter meeting since Jay Bruce. So very excited for Will to be here. So we'll try to interview him and have that podcast as well. That should be up on Friday.
Great.
But again, thanks for the download, everyone. Thanks for sticking with us on a relatively long Rule 5 podcast. We definitely have the Rule 5 fever. So thanks again, and we will be back again, as you heard, later this week. So long, everybody.